It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a growing number of physicians in Wisconsin say they're burned out. We'll find out why and how it could affect patients. First, while the end of summer feels as though it should be right around the corner, Wisconsin residents are seeing one of the worst hallmarks of the season still going really strong: mosquitoes. The small, buzzy bloodsuckers are out in full force thanks to weeks of rain and standing water, and mosquito swarms have led to some sporting events being canceled in northern Wisconsin and some schools canceling field trips outside. Our next guest is here to talk about why we're seeing so many mosquitoes and when it might end. Jamie Hubbard is an associate professor of biology at UW Stevens Point. Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Jamie, I feel like there's a lot of mosquitoes out there, and I keep hearing from other people they're finding the same. Is this unusual? Are we seeing a really unusually large amount of mosquitoes right about now?
We are seeing a very unusually large number of mosquitoes out there, especially in the south, but we're really seeing large numbers of mosquitoes everywhere. I can attest to that, having been out in the woods this weekend.
But do we do biologists do some kind of mosquito census or something like that?
Yes, people who study mosquitoes will regularly survey for the mosquitoes, especially Dr. Susan Paskowitz's lab in UW-Madison does regular surveys for mosquitoes, and they're finding quite a few more mosquitoes this year than in past years at the same time.
So what are the main causes of this?
Well, one of the big main causes this year of the large number of mosquitoes that we've had is the sheer amount of rain that we've had recently, especially the flooding that we've had in the south. But really, we've had quite a bit of rain just about everywhere in Wisconsin recently. So that's one thing. And then the next thing is that the warm temperatures that we've had late in the season. So if you have a combination of rain and the mosquito larvae develop in water, so if you have lots of standing water around and you have also really warm temperatures, that means that you're going to get lots of mosquitoes. The warm temperatures will increase the rate at which they develop, very dependent on temperature. And so warmer temperatures means faster life cycles and more mosquitoes.
So if I was trying to breed myself a bumper crop of mosquitoes over the last few weeks, this was perfect. This is exactly what I would be shooting for.
This is exactly what they needed. Yep.
And there was a big, I guess, hatching of mosquitoes. I'd like to think that, getting mid to late September now, we're not going to see another round of mosquitoes, but are we likely to?
It is possible. So it does look like it's going to cool down a little bit. But if the temperatures were to come up again, then those mosquitoes will develop pretty quickly, and we could see another hatch of adult mosquitoes. One of the things that has really increased our number of mosquitoes recently is, like I said, all the rain that we've had. And those are particular kinds of mosquitoes called the inland floodwater mosquitoes and maybe some tree hole mosquitoes that are going to be the number one type of mosquito coming after big rains that we've had.
Should we be looking back at last winter for part of the story here?
Yes, definitely. So another factor in the sheer number of mosquitoes that we've had is that we've seemed to have had much milder winters, so a lot of snow cover, which insulates the larvae and eggs and even adults that may spend the winter time. That means that they're insulating really well, and then also we don't have as long periods of really super cold temperatures. So we don't have as much mosquito die-off over the winter. So when spring comes around, then we have more mosquitoes than we ordinarily would have in the spring when we have a scenario like that. And so then there's more mosquitoes in the spring available to just continue those mosquitoes perpetuating through the summer.
We are talking about a big mosquito season with Jamie Hubbard, associate professor of biology at UW Stevens Point. Jamie, do biologists, mosquito experts worry about the impact of climate change when it comes to how many mosquitoes we get and how long the mosquito season is?
Most definitely. I know that in Wisconsin we are seeing a trend of having shorter winter periods. So the season in which we have snow and really cold temperatures is becoming shorter and shorter over time. And when that happens, we start seeing the mosquito populations come out much earlier in the spring and stay around much later in the fall. And as I mentioned earlier, also we don't see as much die-off of the mosquitoes over the winter, so we have larger populations beginning right away in the springtime. And if we also see warmer temperatures over the summer and more rainfall coming our way due to more drastic weather patterns, then we're going to see more standing water that those mosquitoes can develop in.
We have an email from Pete who says, a report from the front lines in Reedsburg, the mosquitoes in downtown Reedsburg are epic, not bad, epic. It would have to improve a lot to be merely bad. Thanks for that, Pete. Well, one thing people might wonder about is we know that mosquitoes around the world do carry diseases, lots of different diseases. Is this a concern with, as you're saying, the kind of mosquitoes we have a lot of in Wisconsin right now?
A little bit. So we do have some kinds of mosquitoes that just kind of are present all of the time, and they tend to lay their eggs more on water that's standing all the time, so in slow areas of streams and ponds and even if in buckets of water that you might have around your house or gutters. And those mosquitoes are the ones that carry West Nile virus. So, but the warm temperatures that we're having can increase the number of those mosquitoes and increase the rate of their development, and so we have more hatches of those types of mosquitoes around. The mosquitoes that are the floodwater mosquitoes that come after big rains and that, you know, are going to lay their eggs in places where they're anticipating there will be water, so they lay the eggs and then the water comes after the rain or with the rain, and then it floods these areas, and then those mosquito eggs hatch out. Those mosquitoes are not known to really be big virus transmitters. They do carry dog heartworm, so there is a greater risk for that. However, there is a recent study that came out in 2017 that shows that that floodwater mosquito may have the capability of transmitting Zika virus. It doesn't transmit West Nile virus, but it may have a capability of transmitting Zika virus, which really we weren't thinking of as being a huge problem in Wisconsin. But the problem with that, we really don't know whether they're actually going to be able to transmit that virus or not, because that virus is going to require lots of human hosts. And it's unknown whether this mosquito is going to have enough human hosts to be able to effectively transmit Zika virus in this area.
In our last minute, Jamie, in my head, I'm thinking, okay, we just got to make it to the first frost that'll take out the mosquitoes and my zucchini plants, which I'm okay with at this point. Am I right? Does that first frost really cut down on the number of mosquitoes?
It does. As I said, they're very dependent on temperature. And so if the temperature goes low, especially at nighttime, and we see that temperature stay low, then the number of mosquitoes will start to die down. Of course, as the temperature goes up a little bit, we'll see another kind of rise in the number of, really more in the activity of the mosquitoes that are out there already.
We'll leave it there for now. Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
Jamie Hubbard is an associate professor of biology at the UW-Stevens Point. She joined us for a look at a bumper crop of mosquitoes in much of Wisconsin right now. The Wisconsin Medical Society says signs of physician burnout are present and growing in Wisconsin. 87% of doctors said they experienced some symptoms of burnout in a study from the group last year. That's up 5% since 4 years ago, and it's 5% higher than the national rate. Dr. Bud Chumbly is CEO of the Wisconsin Medical Society. He was a practicing OBGYN for 36 years. Dr. Chumbly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what is burnout, and what does it look like for a physician in particular?
Well, burnout, I think, simply stated, is lack of joy in the profession, feeling you don't get any positive reinforcement from your job, getting overwhelmed and feeling that you're not performing at the peak level. You're not doing what you were trained to do as a physician. I think most physicians go into medicine to care for patients and to care about patients, but with the workload and the EMR and a number of other reasons, I think they no longer see that as happening. And burnout is is a kind of a shorthand way of saying that they're unhappy and they're depressed and they're thinking about leaving medicine or cutting back on their hours.
You have been surveying doctors about signs of burnout and causes of burnout. You mentioned some of them there, and one of them you mentioned is EMR. That's electronic medical records. Why is that a part of the cause of physician burnout?
Well, the EMR came into existence probably 15 years ago with a lot of promise to help physicians manage a lot of the data around physicians, but. Yeah, it really doesn't. It's a way to store data, a lot of data points, but it doesn't really help the physician manage the patient. It's really become an assistance for the billing office and for tracking measures, some quality measures, some management measures. But as it's morphed into that, the physician has been asked to put in all those measures, and so they spend about for every hour they spend in patient contact, it's estimated they spend 2 hours on the electronic medical record, loading in data and working with that with the electronic medical record. So the time that they are allowed to they have to spend face to face and making complex medical decisions has been reduced. And again, this is not what they went to school to do, is to load in clerical information into an electronic medical record. It really didn't fulfill its original promise to the profession that it was going to help them make clinical decisions.
Are there fixes you're looking for changing? I assume there's no going back in some ways on electronic medical records, but are there ways to use them to use doctors' time more efficiently so they're not, as you say, spending more time filling in those records than talking to patients?
Well, there are ways to do that. You could, in some systems are experimenting with having other people do that, whether it's scribes or whether it's assistants that will be with the doctor in the exam room and fill in the electronic medical record for them so that they can concentrate on what they do best which is making complex medical decisions and having a relationship with the patient. There's also a lot of thought being given to transforming those electronic medical records into, an actual something that will help the physician identify exactly, where that patient is in the course of their illness or in the course of their care. So all that information comes to the forefront automatically when he brings up the patient in the electronic medical record. So it's a complete summary, of their health record, and it doesn't have to be searched through. Another problem physicians have is that, any record is only as good as the data that's put in. And much of the data, some of the data that's put in is not accurate, and so if you can't rely on it, you end up asking the questions anyhow about their health history.
We've been digging into one of the big causes there of burnout among doctors. Let's talk about the consequences now. First, for the physicians themselves, in a piece you wrote about this, physicians apparently have a substantially higher suicide rate than the general public. So worst case, this is a life or death issue for a doctor.
Yes, the suicide rate is 4 to 5 times the population, and they're much better at it, unfortunately, than the normal population, and this is ultimately the worst case scenario, and we see this in young physicians as well as old physicians. And it's really an alarming trend, and it's on the way up. And we've seen this in Wisconsin as well. And it's a shame when you see a physician in mid-career or early in their career get to the point where they feel that the only way out, of the situation is to end their life.
And even if we don't get that worst-case situation, there's a concern, you write, that a doctor suffering burnout may not be able to provide the best possible care to their patients. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, I think it behooves me to say that we have excellent care in Wisconsin. We're always number one or number two by a lot of criteria from the federal government. So we are providing, you know, great care. But I think it just goes to say, if you're, you know, if you're focusing on the electronic medical record, or you're focusing on federal regulations or insurance regulations or the barriers to producing some of that care that are out there, that can affect the ultimate care that a physician's able to provide. And if they get significantly burned out, that, you know, that can affect their concentration and I suppose affect their ability to, you know, care for that patient.
Talking to Dr. Bud Chumbly, CEO of the Wisconsin Medical Society. We're talking about physician burnout in Wisconsin. Let's look at some more solutions now, Dr. Chumbly. As I was reading your piece about how doctors can take care of themselves, I was thinking of a metaphor on an airplane where they say, you know, put that air mask on yourself, then you're going to be able to help others around you. You then use that exact metaphor as I was reading on. Talk about what doctors can do to take care of themselves at an individual level, first of all, so that they can provide the best care for their patients.
Well, I think it's important that they, you know, first of all, realize that this is a problem, and I think most of them have. I think the nation has realized it's a problem. There's been, you know, a piece written in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I think the healthcare systems have realized that it's a problem. Everybody's written a great deal about it. There is no silver bullet to solving it, and everybody's coming up with different things. You know, I believe just getting networking, not eating lunch at your desk, but networking with your fellow physicians. You know, getting back into your social life, spending time with your family is very important. You know, the physicians have a tendency. You know, what we're taught is really, if there's more work to do, you just buckle down and you do it. But there is a limit, you know, to what you're able to do and how much you're able to, of your time and effort you're able to expend before you do, you know, become burned out.
Now, more and more, of course, doctors are not, they can't decide their own destiny on some of these things. They are employees of someone else, a health system, for example. What can people who are in charge of employing and scheduling doctors do to help make what you just said happen?
Well, I think in understanding that it's a problem, understanding what other health systems have done to improve that. You know, about a year and a half ago, there were CEOs of 20 systems that pledged to make this a higher priority. And so there are now a lot of conferences that concentrate on improving physician well-being. You're seeing C-suite level people being identified as you know, senior VP of physician well-being in different large systems. So they actually will focus on that and try different things, you know, trying to improve the electronic medical records. I think that's a partnership between healthcare systems and the ER manufacturers. You know, so far, I don't think we've seen a lot of focus on ER manufacturers on that issue because they're so busy installing them and still at this point. But I think we're getting to the point where it's become known that this is a significant problem. You know, we are trying to identify those people responsible for physician well-being and resiliency at the major systems of Wisconsin and act as a convener and see if we can get people talking to each other what works and what doesn't work, and so that we can spread that knowledge across the state.
On a related note, I talked to someone who'd done research on a physician shortage here in Wisconsin, a shortfall in the number of physicians are going to need in the years to come. Are you seeing that from your position with the Medical Society, and do you see that as a bigger problem down the road?
Well, there absolutely is a shortage heading our way. The medical schools have done a good job of expanding their residency slots and their medical student slots with additional campuses in Green Bay and Wausau. And so we are doing some things to fill that, but my concern is if we don't address the burnout problem, you know, we'll be, for every new physician we bring on, we're going to lose two to early retirement or a move into an administrative role or a non-clinical role that they perceive as less stressful. You know, when I was in administrative positions, many people would come up to me as, you know, how do I move into a fully administrative job? And that would take the pressure off my clinical work. And it's just harder to practice medicine now with all the barriers and all the social determinants. The patients seem to have, you know, high deductibles, you know, high copays. It's harder to get them the care that they really need, which I think causes stress in the physicians as well.
Now, if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like you're seeing, even though the numbers have gotten worse a little bit over the years, you're seeing good news, it sounds like, in that a lot of key players are taking this issue of physician burnout seriously. Do I have that right?
Yes, I think there is some good news there, that they are taking it seriously, and that's a key focus of the medical society, and that's what we're going to be pushing for. And I, as I go around and talk to leaders of systems in the state, they say this is high on their priority list. And there is, you would assume that would be, because that's their main workforce. That's what, you know, that's who sees the patients and drives the systems. And if they experience a lot of turnover there, it that's very expensive for them to have a lot of physician turnover. And so, and it's important from a state level to provide the physicians that we need in the future.
Very briefly, if there's a doc out there listening saying, yeah, this is me, I'm feeling burnout right now, what's your message to them?
Well, my first message is a pretty simple one, is that don't eat lunch at your desk. You know, find a colleague to go to lunch and talk about it, you know, and reconnect with your, you know, with your friends outside of work. There's more to life than your electronic medical record, and go seek that out, and then, you know, talk to the people who are influencers, you know, in your system. There are statistics out there that say that only 10% of physicians feel that they can influence the healthcare system at all.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Dr. Bud Chumbly with the Wisconsin Medical Society. He joined us to talk about a growing number of physicians experiencing burnout across the state. Coming up after the news, are you suffering from politics fatigue? We'll talk to a journalism professor about the onslaught of political news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at the back and forth between Leah Vukmir and Tammy Baldwin over the scandal at the Tomah VA Medical Center. First, turn on the radio or the TV, and you'll probably get a lot of this kind of thing.
Happening now, breaking news, election secrets exposed.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tearing into John Kerry for meeting with Iranian officials and undermining the Trump administration.
A sharp divide for Republicans over race. This year,
if Democrats win, and at this point that could definitely happen, maybe it's even likely to happen, they will immediately try to impeach the president. Now, they claim they're not planning to do that.
President Trump today did something striking and really without precedent in the White House or this White House or any White House until now. He signaled in plain English.
The U.S. Senate was releasing this report today.
So it all probably sounds pretty familiar. Fighting over politics isn't anything new, a hallmark of journalism. But the tenor, tone, and frequency of news stories seems to have changed since the 2016 election. News from the White House, various investigations, and political infighting on Capitol Hill have become commonplace. While the steady stream of drama from Washington, D.C. might help some media companies, it might be overwhelming for many Americans. According to a Pew Research survey, nearly 7 out of 10 Americans are experiencing news fatigue. And the impact of the nonstop political news coverage could have some long-term effects, namely on how people engage with the political process. Mike Wagner is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison and an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. He blogs at prowag.me. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
Well, is this a thing, political fatigue, political burnout?
I think so. You know, especially in the age in which we live where, you know, it used to be that if you wanted to catch up with the news, you got it in the morning paper and then at 5:30 on all three channels when the news was on, right? And now you can get news from anywhere at any time, and you even get news in places where you might not go looking for it, like social media. You might go to Facebook or Twitter to see what's going on with your friends, and then you see a bunch of posts about politics. And so it's increasingly hard to avoid the news, although many people still try hard to do so.
is this a story of we are in the Trump post-election era seeing lots more stories, lots more controversy out there? Or is it a story of what you just said, the media availability? Or is there a little bit of both going on?
I think it's an interaction between them. So on the one hand, as I was just saying, it's just way easier to get inundated with information because of technology and kind of the media ecology that we live in. On the other hand, we have a president now who, when there is a controversy, doesn't behave in ways that most leaders behave when there is a controversy, which is to either stay quiet or try to redirect the conversation toward a substantive issue. Most presidents, when something is going wrong for them, try to make a policy proposal or start some kind of new initiative, whereas President Trump finds another controversy to take away from whatever the controversy of the minute is. And there are times when what started the day as the big story is gone by the afternoon, which is just very different than how we lived even 3 or 4 years ago.
Is this a case where candidate Donald Trump and President Donald Trump maybe understood the way our media works in a way that many other politicians did not, and how to put himself into that process?
You know, some of my colleagues at UW-Madison have done research where they conclude that President Trump is a social media savant. He is just very adept at intuitively, it seems, understanding what will get attention from his base, from the news media, and then from those who will hear about what he's doing from the news media. And so using those different avenues to not necessarily control the conversation, but to help make sure that the conversation doesn't dwell on any one thing that he doesn't want it dwelling on.
Let's look at how news providers behave now. You mentioned in the old days, okay, if I'm a TV news producer, I'm competing with two other networks. If I'm a newspaper editor, maybe I've got the crosstown competition, but that's about it. Now there's this huge competition for eyeballs between 24-hour cable news channels, social media, news sites. Is this driving a different kind of coverage that, yeah, maybe it lures people in, but it also burns them out?
There is a little bit, I think, to that, and part of it is that, as you say, that kind of coverage does lure people in. If it didn't lure people in, news sources would stop doing it. They would try to do something else to lure people in. And so part of it, I think, is just as you say, that the style of coverage is at once kind of titillating on the one hand and exhausting on the other hand. Another part of it is the political strategies that the two parties are engaged in. Part of it is the different set of incentives that different media have, and part of it, I think, is kind of the economic bottom line for what can media companies use as metrics to sell to advertisers to say we're successful, we're worthy of you spending your money to help us keep the lights on and cover the news.
Talking to UW-Madison professor Mike Wagner about information fatigue, political news burnout, and people have been commenting on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Curtis, who says, nothing left of me but ash. I'm so burned out on political news and the asinine comments of both parties. I read, listen to music, play silly games on Facebook, work in the yard, etc. So Curtis turns away when he can, but big picture, Mike, is there a concern that if people are in fact feeling fatigue from all the political news, it might lead people to not want to participate in the political system?
It can lead to a few negative outcomes, something psychologists refer to as cognitive load, right? We've all experienced stressful times where we just can't handle one more thing. And sometimes the news cycle behaves in that same kind of way, where there's Bob Woodward's new book out, and then there's an anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, and then President Trump's campaign chairman seems to have flipped to Robert Mueller in the investigation into Russia's involvement in the election. At the same time, there's a Supreme Court nomination, and at the same time, there's information that that nominee might have sexually assaulted someone, and then there's comments from the right and the left as to whether that person should be heard and in what venue and how, and it just gets to be a ton. And sometimes what can happen is people can just shut down and say, okay, no more. Something else that can happen is people say, well, that's it, a pox on both your houses, everybody is bad in the same way, which is not a very, you know, careful and deliberative way to consider what kind of representation we're getting from our leadership.
Want to bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think the media is playing a huge role in a lot of people's political fatigue. I really do. President Trump will put some tweet out, and then you'll turn on the news, and the news media will dedicate an entire segment about that tweet. It's already been out. He tweeted it. People have made some comments on that tweet, but now we got to listen to it on the mainstream media. Then we got to listen to it on our app for like Flipboard or something. So it's just a constant beating of the same drum over and over again until the next news cycle comes, the next tweet comes, and then everybody's hanging on every little word. I think the media really needs to start looking at the quality of the news that they're delivering to us and see whether or not, okay, is this really worth the time? There are other things we could dedicate the time to, local media, local news, local politics, governor races, things like that. Kind of keep it a little bit more down to earth instead of ranting off about every little thing that President Trump does.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for calling in. Mike, Jeremy gave us a lot to work with there. Let's start with when the president tweets, how much is the media obliged to cover it?
So the news media seem drawn to like a moth to a flame to President Trump's tweets on occasion, but it's not necessarily his tweets as much as it is the reaction to them. And so in some research done by some of my colleagues at UW, Josephine Lucido and Devon Shah and John Peavyhouse and others did a group project where they examined media response to the president's tweets. And what they found is that it's really when they're getting shared, when they're getting retweeted a lot, that is kind of a signal to the news media that people are really talking about this one, and so we should cover it. And so part of it is that the news media are covering those tweets because a lot of people are sharing those tweets. Now, it's also the case that a lot of bots on social media are sharing those tweets and kind of ginning up the attention to reach levels that they don't actually reach with real humans, and so that's part of it. And then the other thing your caller mentioned was about local news, and it's not really the case that local news is as interested in say, the president's Twitter behavior as they are in local news. Local news, especially local television news, still tends to rank number one for people when it comes to where they get their information, and they usually lead with local stories and not what the president's doing on Twitter.
But is there, I think what Jeremy, in addition to local reporting, is maybe make the case that I've heard out there that, okay, maybe we don't need that insider Washington-type politics following the latest hot Washington story of the day. We need more substantive stuff. I've seen that from one of the founders, I think, of Politico, which was kind of the poster child for insider political coverage. Is there a case there that the media could be bringing us something a little richer and deeper if they devoted fewer resources to the daily twists and turns?
Absolutely. I think for people interested in this idea, Jay Rosen, who's a journalism professor who blogs a lot and writes a lot in popular media, writes a lot about the benefits of outsider coverage and says we, as you were saying, do way too much. Here's what officials at the White House or maybe in the state, here's what officials in the governor's mansion or the state house say. And we would be benefiting if more national journalists especially were engaged in richer kinds of journalism that required less inside sources and more covering of government documents and use of resources, covering more individuals who work in the bureaucracy to see how efficient government is operating, to see who's getting left behind in the country, to see who's benefiting at the expense of others, the kinds of things that aren't part and parcel of insider source type coverage.
We're talking to Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He's an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. He blogs at prowag.me, and he's with us to talk about news burnout, specifically political news, and the impact it might have on people's news consumption and maybe their political participation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you experiencing political news fatigue? Does it make you want to pay attention less to the news? How else does it impact you? What do you do about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation now about political news burnout and the impact it might have on voters. Our guest is Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you feeling worn out? Does it sometimes seem like too much to see or read or hear one more story about politics, maybe especially national politics? Or no, you're not feeling that at all. Give you more. And what do you do to deal with the constant flow of news? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go back to our callers now. Ross is with us in Middleton. Ross, hi.
Hi. So my comment is, I'm kind of on the opposite end, and it's because I think maybe because of these smartphones, maybe computers, that it's almost more of a borderline obsession with sort of going minute to minute, sort of like how news events are kind of going, like what's happening with the Kavanaugh thing now. And it's sort of, it isn't really a fatigue, although I suspect that maybe over time, maybe like, I don't know, months or years or something, I may just get pooped out of it. But I'm kind of on the opposite end. It seems like I'm following it a bit too much.
Ross, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that. Ross, I'm guessing Mike is not alone. A lot of people following their whatever Twitter feed, news updates in whatever form they get them, to keep up to the minute.
Right. You know, it's always dangerous to say there are two kinds of people, but sometimes for analytic purposes it's useful. And if we think about some people are like your caller, who are kind of, you know, news junkies, and they love, you know, seeking out the news. They love knowing the latest things that are happening at all levels of government. And other people are more entertainment junkies who would love to, you know, figure out when the marvelous Mrs. Maisel is coming back to Amazon Prime or whatever, and wait to watch the next shows, and would do whatever they could to avoid the news. And both kinds of people, when they click on the stuff they're interested in, kind of have the parts of their brain light up that are associated with pleasure. And so kind of psychologists who study information seeking find that both news junkies and entertainment junkies really, really like their style of information seeking. And it's something that in some cases can even, you know, be habit forming, or, you know, at the most extreme cases, kind of addictive kinds of behavior. And you all probably know someone who is constantly checking their phone, constantly refreshing their Facebook stream or WPR's homepage or the New York Times' homepage or whatever their favorite source is.
Ross, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Martha with us in Menominee. Martha, hi.
Hi there. You know, I'm loving all this hot political stuff. It just makes me want to go vote. I feel fortunate to live in this digital analog age where when the president lies, I know about it right away. I feel fortunate to be informed. And I think, you know, the last election, a lot of people went on emotion and not information. And so I'm going to educate myself and get my information, and I don't confuse journalists with entertainers. So, you know, I carefully digest my news. And when it gets to be too much, you know, there's always the off switch. So,
Martha, thanks a lot for calling and not turning us off. Mike, what do you think?
That sounds like a healthy way of approaching things. Staying informed as much as you can, and if it gets to be too much, find something else to do for a little bit. That's a reasonable way, I think, to proceed.
Thanks a lot for that call, Martha, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mike Wagner about political news fatigue. Back to your calls. Tasha is on the line in Madison. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to call. I'm a political organizer for a nonpartisan political action committee, so I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. I don't really get tired of political news, but I really wish, like, 24-hour news cycles would stop covering Trump and, like, other political trolls' tweets, because we're just giving them attention, and that's exactly what they want.
Tasha, thanks for the call. Mike?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the case, I think, that the president's social media behavior is designed in part to draw attention away from some things and toward other things. And given the way that it's so much easier now for both individuals who want to follow the news and organizations that report the news to learn from each other, it's the case that news organizations can understand, oh, this is hot right now, this is trending, this is generating a lot of clicks or generating a lot of Google searches, and that can cause more coverage, which can then cause more people to learn about something because they see that coverage, which might generate more interest. And it kind of is this perpetuating cycle of kind of uptaking different kinds of agendas. And that is certainly something that happens. And sometimes I think it's strategic, and sometimes it's a little bit more random, but it has similar effects.
want to visit our, thanks for that call, Tasha, visit our Ideas Network Facebook page. Tyrone writes, I'm not burned out. I read, listen to, and watch a fair amount of political news. Much of the news is maddening, but I try to remain engaged and deal with it through writing or speaking about it. And Chris writes, I enjoy the political humor, especially like Samantha Bee or John Oliver. It's satire. The other thing I know is when to say, this is just a bit too much today. Mike, some people maybe have that sort of insulated filter through satire, as we heard from Chris there.
That's right, and different kinds of people like different kinds of humor, and research done by Dana Young shows that girls in particular kind of like satire and irony a bit more and are more likely to watch the John Oliver, Stephen Colbert, Samantha Bee type programs. And conservatives like a little bit broader humor and humor with less irony and less satire, and they might like Jimmy Fallon a little bit more, or, you know, the old-style Tonight Show under Jay Leno or before that Johnny Carson. And so people of different ideological orientations prefer different kinds of humor, which, you know, are ways to deal with the information overload, but are also just ways to kind of cool down at the end of the day, whether you were following the news or not.
Let's go back to our callers. Jan is with us in Middleton. Jan, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I really like NPR's and you guys, Wisconsin Public Radio's take on some of the news, because I want meat. I don't want frivolous. I don't eat ice cream or candy. I want the good stuff in there. And so I'm just really tired of all the fluff that's going on and all the misdirection that's happening in tweeting world and social media, and then the firestorm of people responding and opinioning afterwards.
Jan, thanks a lot for the call. Mike, I'll say just informally among people I know, friends and family, I think I have about an equal number of people who say, Rob, I turn your show off when there's too much politics, and Rob, I turn your show off when there's not enough politics. So there's different schools of thought there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, some people are kind of media omnivores in a researcher from Northwestern, Steph Edgerly's phrasing, where they like all kinds of information, news, entertainment, whatever they can get. And other people are looking for liberal news or conservative news or any kind of news. And other people, search out just the information that tells them they're right. And we live in an era where all of those different kinds of people can find sources that are just for them.
Thanks for that call. Jan, we'll go back to your calls. Mike is with us in Rice Lake. Mike, hi.
Hi, how you guys doing? I just want to comment. Since I was a little kid, I was delivering newspapers. I was reading the paper every day. Really was a real news junkie and consistently watching, you know, all the news I could get, NPR, PBS, and networks too. But the last 2 years, it's gotten such a bombardment daily, if not hourly, of all this stuff, where I found that now I'll go to my browser and look at the headlines, but I rarely even click through because I just want to know, say, what's going on in general. But I'm tired of the details because it's tiring. It's fatiguing.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And Mike Wagner, we just have a few moments left. I mean, I'm trying to keep up with the news. There's just so much out there. It's hard to do much more than keep up with the headlines sometimes.
It's impossible to know everything that's available to us because there's literally an infinite amount of information out there that we can never fully get. And so it can feel overwhelming, and people need, I think, to figure out what's most important to them, what's important to their communities, and where can they go and who can they trust to give them the best information to help them make the best decisions possible for themselves.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to all our callers. And Mike, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison and an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. He also blogs at prowag.me. He joined us today to talk about whether people are getting burned out on all the political news out there and what impact that could have on people's political behavior. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this issue. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. A lot of comments there. Are you feeling burned out by too much political news? And when you feel that way, what do you do about it? Do you give yourself a media timeout or what? Join us at the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Look, I want to help, but I haven't played basketball in a long time. My timing's all off.
Yeah, we'll fix your timing. Look at our facilities.
It's Michael Jordan and Bugs Bunny in the movie Space Jam from back in 1996. Today we're hearing about a sequel in the works starting LeBron James. I was a little old. My kids were too young for me to be in the sweet spot for the original Space Jam. Producer J. Carlisle Larson was there, though. Hey.
Oh, yeah.
This was a
so
formative movie.
For this, yes. And, you know, there have been rumors for a little while about a sequel to Space Jam.
For years, you were saying.
For years, yeah, because when I was at a previous station, there were rumors, and I wrote a small news story about it that didn't make it to the air, but was very excited, and my friends were all very excited about it because it was extremely formative.
Yeah, what was it about, having not seen it myself, what was it about Space Jam?
Honestly, it felt like just the trippiest movie you could possibly see as a child in the 90s. And you have the Looney Tunes, which admittedly I was not into as a kid. I didn't like the Looney Tunes things, but I did really like the Chicago Bulls. So somehow the combination of both of those things seemed to work.
So a sequel with LeBron James and presumably Bugs Bunny and the rest you would go see in the theater?
I probably would, more out of nostalgia than anything, and only if the soundtrack was as good as the one, the original one in 1996.
We'll leave it with the soundtrack here on Central Time.